Hello, this is Terrence McNally. With impeachment hearings starting and the consciences of the Republican Party and the American people on the line, let's listen to a couple of past heroes, men of principle, including one whose electoral opponent resigned rather than face his own impeachment. In the first half, longtime senator and 1972 Democratic presidential candidate George McGovern, followed by my conversation with Howard Zinn, a leader of the anti-Vietnam War movement and author of A People's History of the United States. Both were recorded in 2005.
I was 23, a couple of years out of college in 1972, when I packed all my belongings in a used van and traveled to Mexico. I was going to go to San Miguel de Allende and become an artist. I was, for the first time, letting myself do that. I created the most idyllic life, surrounded by beauty and nature, living with a few other would-be artists and yoga folk, and buying fresh fruit every day in the Mercado. But each week, I got the International Time magazine, and each day, I read the International Trib, and I saw a little-known senator from South Dakota, at first exceeding expectations and then actually winning Democratic primaries. I read whatever I could get my hands on. Decades before the internet, of course, in addition to his pledge to begin withdrawing U.S. troops from Vietnam on Inauguration Day, he was for universal health care, a guaranteed minimum income, tax reform. Not only that, his was a grassroots campaign, not controlled by the party bosses or the professionals, one in which someone like myself could actually make a difference. I couldn't resist. I left Paradise, drove back to the States in time to work the last two primaries in California and New York, and the convention in Miami. And as a reward for my efforts, I was given the job of running the most conservative Democratic Assembly District in California. At that point, the 52nd, Southeast LA County, consisting of a few Latinos, a lot of Humphrey-loving unionists who would never forgive McGovern, and to the right of them, Wallace folks. Acknowledging that reality, I was asked to win 37% of the vote. And without a college or a junior college, without a single affluent neighborhood, with a canvassing army of mostly high school students, that's what we did. We got 37%. Unfortunately, that's all the campaign got nationally, losing to Richard Nixon 49 states to one. And in our campaign office in Downey, California, we wept. Well, today, as America is engaged in another unwinnable war, initiated again through government deception, that presidential candidate, George McGovern, is my guest. Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. Let me tell you one other thing before I bring in George McGovern. There is a movie opening this weekend in Los Angeles, a documentary on his grassroots anti-war campaign called One Bright Shining Moment. It opens at the Music Hall 3 in Beverly Hills, Doheny and Wilshire. And interviewees in that movie include McGovern, Gore Vidal, Gloria Steinem, Warren Beatty, Dick Gregory, Gary Hart. And not only that, but George McGovern and the writer, director, producer, Stephen Vittoria, will be present at the theater Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday during the day for Q&As around the film. George McGovern was a decorated World War II bomber pilot. His wartime exploits were at the center of Stephen Ambrose's The Wild Blue. He was a professor at Dakota Wesleyan. He ran the Food for Peace program under John Kennedy, represented South Dakota for two terms in the House, three terms in the Senate. And his opposition, as I said, to the Vietnam War fueled a grassroots campaign that won the 1972 Democratic presidential nomination, only to lose to Richard Nixon. Many members of Nixon's committee to reelect the president later served jail time for Watergate-connected crimes. He's written 9 books, the last two of which were The Essential America, Our Founders in the Liberal Tradition, and his most recent, Ending Hunger Now, A Challenge to Persons of Faith. Welcome, George McGovern, to KPFK and Free Forum.
It's good to be on with you today.
Okay, so you heard my story of how I was just one of the thousands and thousands of McGovern's army.
I was so moved by your introduction and what you did in 72 that I've told my hosts here they have to let me stay here until 25 minutes after the hour, so that'll give us a little more time to talk.
I thank you, and I really do thank you, because I know when 10 minutes ago I was told that I would only have you till quarter after, so thank you very much. I want listeners to get to know the people behind the work, the ideas, and the movements, and so on. How did you end up running for president, George McGovern?
It was the war in Vietnam. You know, I was a junior senator from a little state with only 3 electoral votes. I don't think that I would have been compelled to get in that race for the presidency were it not for my anguish over what seemed to me to be an outrageously mistaken war in Vietnam. So that was the driving force that brought me into that race.
And this all is spelled out in the film One Bright Shining Moment, but you'd voted for the Gulf of Tonkin, which you say is the decision you most regret in your life. You, however, were an opponent from the very start. And was it just that as you looked around after the 68 in which Nixon had beaten Humphrey, and you looked around prior to 72 and said, someone's got to do it?
That's right. I felt that the case had not been made among the Democratic presidential hopefuls, and that somebody had to make that case. We couldn't simply say, well, we're for the war, we can run it better than the Republicans. That didn't wash with me, and I don't think it would have with the American people. Obviously, the Vietnam issue was not the only one, but it was the transcendent issue, and it was tearing this country apart. I honestly believe that until we terminated our mistaken involvement in that war in Southeast Asia, that we weren't going to really be able to address the other problems before the country.
Very clear, very clear. Let me, what I want to do for most of the time I have you today, George, is talk about what the lessons of 72 and that period for the present. But before I do, let me ask you this question. Your campaign and the reforms the McGovern Commission instituted in the nomination and convention process are at least partially blamed, have been ever since, for the failures of the Democratic Party ever since. What's your perspective on that, and is there truth to that, or what's the real meaning?
It's a total fiction. You know, those reforms were mandated by the delegates to the 1968 convention. They knew that the party was in a mess. They knew that what was coming across on television was the picture of a party split across the middle over the war and other issues, and that something had to be done to change the way we were picking presidential nominating delegates. For example, in a number of states, not more than 10% of the delegates who were going to nominate our presidential candidate were women. Even though women in every state were slightly more than 50% of the voting public, there were almost no people under 30 on those delegations that went to the 68 convention. Very few blacks, very few Hispanics. All across the board, what you had was a convention largely of middle-aged, middle-class men. Now, I'm not against people like that. I was one myself at that time, but I don't think they ought to dominate the presidential nominating process to the exclusion of women and young people and the minorities. That's not the way American democracy is supposed to work. These people who say those reforms ruined the Democratic Party don't know what they're talking about.
Okay. Let me tell people you're listening to Free Forum, KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with George McGovern, three-term senator from South Dakota and 1972 Democratic presidential candidate, someone who Robert Kennedy, the late Robert Kennedy, described as the most decent man he'd ever met in politics. And from my knowledge of George McGovern over 30-some years, I agree. One Bright Shining Moment, a documentary on his grassroots anti-war campaign, opens this week in L.A. at the Music Hall 3, Wilshire and Doheny in Beverly Hills, opens Friday. And George McGovern and the director, producer, writer of the film, Stephen Vittoria, will be at the theater this weekend for Q&As Friday and Saturday nights and at the daytime shows on Sunday. Quite a treat, a chance to meet a true American hero. What do you think of the current anti-war movement, both outside and inside the political parties? And let me add, have you seen today's news that both the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate have proposals on the table right now that call for Iraqi forces to take the lead next year and for the Bush administration to lay out a strategy for ending the war?
Well, I think that's all to the good, and I'm glad it's happening. It's long overdue. This war is going nowhere. We never should have gotten in there. I don't think you should send young Americans out to die in a foreign country unless America's national security is on the line, unless it's essential to the safety and defense of America. Iraq was no threat to us. They had a miserable dictator in charge of the country, but he had done nothing against us and was no threat to us. And we can't send the American army into every country where they have political problems and hope that we can set things aright. We don't have the power or the responsibility to do that. So I'm glad that even since this last election a year ago, I have seen clearly, as I'm sure our listeners have, I've seen a weakening of support for the war. People are beginning to think it was a mistake. And both the parties are now looking for opportunities, I think, to make a graceful exit out of that mistaken war.
Now, are you afraid, as some would be, I think, that recall in 68, Nixon was elected with a secret plan to end the war? And would you be afraid that that some of these moves would be merely to shore up support for the Republicans in 2006 to take the thunder from those who opposed the war in the Democratic Party or further to the left, and yet actually just slightly reduce the quagmire rather than truly change it?
I think some people are motivated exactly by those considerations. They want a face-saving way. Not to say they were wrong in supporting our entry into this war, but a face-saving way to get out of something that they see no end to. I don't think the American people are going to buy that. They saw that Nixon's secret plan to end the war lasted for 4 years, during which 40% of all the Americans who died in the Vietnam War were killed, almost half of all of our casualties in that war took place after Nixon said he had a secret plan to end the war, and then took another 4 years of fighting and killing and bombing before finally the Congress forced him to terminate our involvement there.
Yes, as you point out in the film, on the day he was elected, he could have done as you pledged to do and begin the withdrawal. Then nothing was gained by the four more years.
And I don't go for these secret plans. That may be the earmarks of a police state. It's not the earmarks of a democracy. I think the American people ought to be told the facts, and the president ought to lay out a plan, a disengagement. I hope that people are not going to buy another one of these so-called secret plans.
Let me read, by the way, I found various quotes from your past, and the acceptance speech you made in 1972 at the Democratic Convention, which I was one of the young folk on the floor there to witness, included these. I'm going to read a few paragraphs, actually, and then I'd like your comments in the view from, as I say, 33 years later. This is the time for truth, not falsehood. In a democratic nation, no one likes to say that his inspiration came from secret arrangements by closed doors. But in the sense, that is how my candidacy began. I'm here as your candidate tonight in large part because during four administrations of both parties, a terrible war has been chartered behind closed doors. I want those doors opened, and I want that war closed. And I make these pledges above all others. The doors of government will be opened, and that war will be closed. This is the time. It is a time for this land to become again a witness to the world for what is just and noble in human affairs. It is a time to live more with faith and less with fear, with an abiding confidence that can sweep away the strongest barriers between us and teach us that we are truly brothers and sisters. From secrecy and deception in high places, come home, America. From military spending so wasteful that it weakens our nation, come home, America. From the entrenchment of special privileges in tax favoritism, from the waste of idle lands to the joy of useful labor, from the prejudice based on race and sex, from the loneliness of the aging poor and the despair of the neglected sick, come home, America. Those were your words in 72. Could you reflect on them now in 2005?
It makes me sad to hear those words spoken so eloquently by you, because when I spoke them, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and 95% of the television audience was in bed, sound asleep. my mother saw and heard me, my wife, the delegates on the convention floor. But that was one of the tragic errors in that 1972 convention. We let primetime television, primetime radio get away from us. That speech should have been delivered about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, somewhere thereabouts, when we had 80 or 90 million people watching that.
Isn't it chilling, though, also to see deception, secrecy, tax privilege? I mean, all these issues 33 years later.
Yeah, it's sad because I've been looking through a book of my major speeches of 72. It's called An American Journey. It's published by Random House right after the 72 campaign. And I was looking up a couple of references there, and I started reading those speeches. And they're as relevant today as when they were delivered in July of 1972. We've got very much the same problems. No adequate health care, no just tax system, no straight-out, straightforward discussion of the central problems of the country, an unwise war. You'd think that nothing had happened.
Yeah, like someone could have gone to sleep that night while they were waiting for your speech, woken up today, and nothing would have changed.
That's right. I think Rip Van Winkle would have had a field day with that situation.
Now, let me ask you to look again from your unique vantage point, having led the most grassroots, principled presidential campaign of my lifetime. Watching your campaign in the movie, it struck me not as a fluke at that point, but as the natural outgrowth of the civil rights movements and the student and the anti-war activism. It made sense that the grassroots would now enter into electoral politics in a big way. Now, what the problem is, though, it looks from the present as if we tried it once. For the first time, inventing it as we went along, we lost to a ruthless, experienced, and wealthy team, many of whom, as I pointed out, ended up doing jail time. And yet, rather than getting a chance to get better at it, we've never had a campaign like it since. It's held up as a failure to be avoided at all costs. If you were talking to a 24-year-old today, what would you tell him or her or millions like them about how to bring that kind of authentic grassroots power to life again and how not to let it die this time?
First of all, tell the truth. That was the key ingredient of the 72 campaign. People were convinced that I was speaking the truth. They didn't argue that I was always right on everything, but they knew that I was proclaiming what I thought was right. I was giving it my best effort to get at the bottom of the central problems before the country and then speak straight out what I thought ought to be the solutions. It's true we lost that campaign, but it triggered in American politics the birth of all kinds of the political movements since then that are still with us. That campaign of 72 wasn't a complete failure. We did force an end to the war in Vietnam. 6 months after the election, Nixon was on the way out of office. Agnew had already resigned. Many people, as you pointed out, were brought to justice and sent off to prison. None of those things happened to anybody in my campaign in 72. It was an honorable, straightforward campaign. We lost, but that doesn't mean that we sacrificed things that were fundamental. We stayed with the truth. We stayed with integrity. I want to tell you how much it means to me to be on this program today, and I hope all your listeners will come see that film that Steve Vittoria has produced. I'm going to be there to greet them.
Okay. Thank you very much, George. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your time over the years since World War II, really. You've been an America hero ever since then, and I look forward to, I'll drop by the theater and meet you this weekend.
I look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I'm Terry McNally, and I have just been speaking with George McGovern, three-term senator from South Dakota, 1972 Democratic presidential candidate, talking about the lessons of that campaign looked at through the perspective from 30-some years later. And there is a film just coming out this weekend called One Bright Shining Moment. It's a documentary of George McGovern and that grassroots campaign. It includes a lot of folks speaking both back then and now about that campaign, produced, written, and directed by Stephen Vittoria. I may bring Stephen in for a moment, but first, I feel the need to say a few words about another frequent guest on this program. The LA Times has fired longtime progressive columnist and Iraq War critic Robert Scheer. And if you disagree, as I do, with this action and will miss his passionate and articulate weekly column, let the Times know how you feel. You would do that at www.latimes.com. And it's a much longer email address than that to actually leave the information, but I'll give it one time. And then if you need it, you can email me, temcnally@att.net. It's www.latimes.com/services/site/la-comment-op-ed. And that should get you to a place where you can leave a letter letting the LA Times know how you feel. There's a demonstration going on even as we speak outside the LA Times building at the First Street entrance, First and Spring down in LA. If you're off lunch at work downtown, you might want to join them. Protesters are going to be distributing slices of Wonder Bread to signify the blending of this newspaper. Scheer had worked at the Times for 30 years. The last 12 as a weekly columnist in the op-ed page. He had a substantial following. His columns were often the most emailed of the story, so it wasn't a question of that he didn't bring in readers. An announcement of the protest read this way: Robert Scheer's anti-war voice is critical. LA Times readers will not tolerate the paper's op-ed page tilting further to the right with the firing of Scheer and with no one holding Scheer's spot as a passionate and contrarian national progressive voice. Scheer himself, in response to his firing, he included the following words. The publisher, Jeff Johnson, who's offered not a word of explanation to me, and there was an article in today's LA Times about the changes in the op-ed page, and it again gave no justification. He said, Jeff Johnson has privately told people that he hated every word that I wrote. I assume that mostly refers to my exposing the lies used by President Bush to justify the invasion of Iraq. Fortunately, 60% of Americans now get the point. But only after tens of thousands of Americans and Iraqis have been killed and maimed as the carnage spirals out of control. My only regret is that my pen was not sharper and my words tougher. Let me bring in Stephen Vittoria here for, we'll have just a couple of minutes. Stephen?
Terry, how are you?
I'm very good. Stephen Vittoria, writer, director, producer of One Bright Shining One, which opens this week at the Music Hall 3. You heard the interview with George?
You know, I sure did, and I've been making the film for a long time, and this was one of those few interviews that actually reminded me why I made the film. I just thought he was brilliant, and he's as relevant now as he was 30 years ago, and unfortunately, his message is as relevant now as it was 30 years ago. We haven't learned a whole hell of a lot, and I think George's message is testament to that.
Yeah, and just to clarify for folks who want the real specifics, what features will they be able to Q&A you and George McGovern at?
The 5:40 showing on Friday evening, the 8:30 showing on Friday evening. Same is true for both shows on Saturday. And on Sunday, I believe, definitely the first matinee, which is, I think, like a 1, 2 o'clock showing, and then probably the second one as well. George McGovern is 83 years old, and I've been all over the country with him with this film from New York to Los Angeles, and he definitely outdistances me, and he can keep it going, but I sometimes have to watch his schedule to make sure we don't tire him out. But he is amazing, and when he gets into a group of people, he's as exhilarating now as he was in 72. A lot of people said he doesn't have charisma, but his ideas have a great deal of charisma. It's probably the only thing we should be listening to.
And as he pointed out, Stephen, when I asked what he would say to people today, he said, tell the truth. The truth is what made that campaign work. And if you think back to 2004, the clearest difference this time between the Republican candidate and the Democratic was once the Democratic candidate, John Kerry, got painted as someone who didn't tell the truth, who wasn't authentic, who wasn't speaking his heart. I don't think he ever overcame that.
I think you're absolutely right.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In the second half, you'll hear my 2005 interview with another hero of mine, a leader of the anti-Vietnam War movement and the author of A People's History of the United States, the late Howard Zinn.
I was in college in Cambridge and Boston in the late 60s when I first saw Howard Zinn. Along with William Sloan Coffin of Yale, Noam Chomsky of MIT, he was a leader of the protests against the Vietnam War. And now, nearly 40 years later, as he speaks against another misguided foreign adventure, he's still vital at 83, and his voice and his vision is still vitally important. Of his newest book, Voices of a People's History of the United States, Zinn has said, "Educators and politicians may say that students ought to learn pure facts, innocent of interpretation, but there's no such thing. Long before I decided to write A People's History, which came out in 1980, my partisanship was shaped by my upbringing in a working-class immigrant family, my 3 years as a shipyard worker, my experience as a bombardier in World War II, and by the civil rights movement in the South and the movement against the war in Vietnam. So I've chosen to emphasize voices of resistance to class oppression, racial injustice, sexual inequality, nationalist arrogance, left out of the orthodox histories." Here in Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, history, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Howard Zinn was raised in a working-class family in Brooklyn and flew bombing missions for the United States in World War II. After the war, he went to college under the GI Bill and received his Ph.D. from Columbia University. He's taught at Spelman College and Boston University and has been a visiting professor at the University of Paris and the University of Bologna. During the Civil Rights Movement, he was an advisor to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, chronicled in his book, SNCC, The New Abolitionists. He was a leading critic of the Vietnam War. Author of many books, A People's History of the United States has sold over 1 million copies since its publication in 1980, and Zinn has received the Thomas Merton Award, the Eugene V. Debs Award, the Upton Sinclair Award, and the Lannan Literary Award. Welcome, Howard Zinn, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Oh, well, thank you for talking to me.
Well, I must mention to you that I've had your daughter, Myla Cabot-Zinn, on the show when she and her husband, John Cabot-Zinn, had written the book Everyday Blessings about mindful parenting.
Oh, yeah.
And I had John on again this year for Coming to Our Senses, so I felt it was about time that
That's
I got
right.
to the root of things.
It's embarrassing to have your daughter beat you to the punch.
Especially on Pacifica.
Son-in-law, yeah. No, it's certainly only right that you should have me, yeah.
So one of the things that I always say is I like listeners to get to know the people behind the ideas and the books and so on. So I've alluded to it in the introduction, but you weren't necessarily destined to be a college professor, were you?
No. I wasn't destined to be one. I wasn't prepared to be one. Certainly my parents didn't expect me to be one. I think, you know, my parents, like most working class parents, just hope their kids will survive and be healthy and, you know, make a living of some sort, you know. And no, I didn't expect to be a college professor. As you pointed out earlier, I was a shipyard worker for 3 years from ages of 18 to 21, then I was in the Air Force. But somewhere along the line, I suppose I got interested in history, got interested in reading, got interested in politics. When I was a teenager, I read Upton Sinclair, and I read Karl Marx. I'm not supposed to say that.
I think the remarkable thing is that you actually read him.
I did not read Volume 3 of Das Kapital, but I read a lot of him. I read Upton Sinclair and Jack London and Lincoln Steffens and all sorts of people who got me excited about the world around us and got me interested in things of fascism and socialism and democracy and all of that. And
And so I suppose when I got out of the Air Force, and I was married and we had a kid and then two kids, and I was knocking around at various jobs, and my wife was working, and it was, you know, sort of typical struggling young working class family living in a low income housing project in Manhattan, and I just decided to go to college under the GI Bill. Marvelous thing, the GI Bill. You know, to this day, when they talk, not just Republicans, but Democrats like Clinton, they say, oh, the era of big government is over. We must get government out of this and government out of that. Well, the government can do marvelous things. Certainly private enterprise is not going to give working-class kids an education. You leave things to the free market, and the rich will go to college, and the poor will go to work.
Well, you know, I was going to share with you, as you were describing, that even after you immediately came back from the war, you didn't leap into college. My dad, who is the same age as you, also came back, was a bombardier in World War II, came back and got an Ivy League education based on that GI Bill, graduating with three children. Very similar situation. That isn't available today.
No, not at all. And in fact, you know, the way tuition has skyrocketed, you know, in the colleges, you know, even in the state colleges, you know, very, very difficult now for families to have their kids go to college. And so colleges are becoming more and more sort of places for the well-to-do, and very difficult for kids in working-class families to go to college. And, well, I mean, it's just part of what has been in these last decades, a polarization of wealth in this country, the rich becoming richer, the poor having children.
Exactly. Let's shift to once you go to college, you come out of Columbia. Was Spelman your first teaching gig?
Well, I had a couple of part-time teaching jobs while I was in graduate school, but Spelman was my first real, you know, full-time teaching job, and I didn't actually choose Spelman. Spelman is a black college, women's college.
Yeah, I was thinking that was an odd fit. How did that happen?
An odd fit, because I'm not black and I'm not a woman, right?
Both, yes.
Really an accident. It wasn't that I chose, you know, I could say, oh, I was such a socially conscious person that I wanted to teach at a black college in the South. No, not so at all. I was just looking for a job. And this job came along, and the president of Spelman College was up north and talking to my advisor at Columbia, and my advisors recommended me, and I met with the president of Spelman, and he offered me the job as chair of this department. Imagine my first job as chair of the department. I mean, a true small department, but still. I hadn't even considered about whether I would teach at a Negro college. I wasn't thinking of Negro colleges. I wasn't aware of that phenomenon, you see. But of course, by that time, certainly I was very conscious of the race question.
How much did that in some sense odd turn in the road affect the rest of your life?
Oh, I think that was critical for the rest of my life. Those 7 years at Spelman and in the South and involved in the movement and involved with SNCC and you know, going from Atlanta, Georgia to Albany, Georgia to report on the demonstrations there, going to Selma, Alabama and Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and I mean those 7 years, those years of what is called the movement in the South, those were very exciting years and educational years, important years, and you know I learned more from that experience, I'm sure, than my students learned from me.
Let me tell people, you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Howard Zinn, author of People's History of the United States and now co-editor of Voices of a People's History of the United States. And you can learn a lot more at www.howardzinn.org. On the book that you wrote in 1980. How did you come to write a people's history of the United States?
Well, you know, when I said that those 7 years in the South were very important to me, I think that had a lot to do with my writing of people's history, because here I was a participant in some of the most exciting things happening in the country and writing about them and realizing that so much of what was going on in the South at the grassroots in these little towns and in Southwest Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama, so much of this was not being reported in the newspapers. They were reporting the big events. You know, sure, they would report the March on Washington, they would report when 10,000 people demonstrated in Birmingham, but so much was happening that was not being reported and not being recorded for history. And it sort of made me realize fully what maybe I had only sort of realized partially, you know. And that is there was a necessity to tell the history of people's movements, of ordinary people, and to tell history from the point of view of people who had been left out of history, tell a history from the point of view of the indigenous peoples, tell a history of the Mexican War from the standpoint of the Mexicans.
Right. In other words, had you been in the ivory tower of an Ivy League school, you would have had an intuition that something was left out, but here you were right among those people, and so the omission was all the more glaring.
Yeah, that's right. And so when I set out to write this book, I knew what I wanted to do, and I was going to tell the story of the anti-slavery movement, you know, from the standpoint of the black abolitionists, because I had been taught about the abolitionist movement in graduate school, but it seemed like mostly a white movement. We taught about Garrison and Phillips and Lovejoy and yes, there was Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, but there was no real understanding of the part that black people played in their own liberation and in their own struggle against slavery. I realize that if you look at history from the point of view of black people, of Native Americans, of women, of working people, everything looks different. All the heroes suddenly are not heroes anymore. You know, and it's still true in traditional history. Andrew Jackson represents democracy, and Theodore Roosevelt represents, I don't know what, but
well, trust busting, I think, is probably
trust busting. Yeah, he busted more human beings in war than he busted trust.
Right.
I mean, he engineered the invasion of the Philippines in a bloody war.
Now, I read in your book that 600,000 died in that war.
That's right. It's very interesting. I know it's startling because we don't learn that in school. We learn about the Spanish-American War, which was a short and victorious war. And then there's some little item about how, then we went and took the Philippines. No, the Philippine War was a long and bloody war. That's sort of in many ways a precursor of the Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
with its massacres and atrocities, and so blatant in as an act of aggression, preventing a people from running their own country. Because the Filipinos wanted, now that the Spaniards were out, they wanted to run the Philippines themselves. But no, the United States wanted the Philippines, and it would do it, yes, at the cost of 600,000 lives.
Out of a population of?
Oh, well, 600,000 lives out of a population of, you know, maybe 15 or 20 million.
Amazing, amazing.
It's huge.
Let me read a quote of yours here, and I'll just let you speak on a little bit. You say that in your work, you want to point out that people who seem to have no power, whether working people, people of color, or women, once they organize and protest and create movements, have a voice no government can suppress. Do you find that's true still today?
Well, no, that's the exercise of power by people is always something in process. It's always something that's ongoing, and so depends on what point in the process you look at. And so, you know, you know, if you look at the movement against racial segregation at an early point in the movement, you won't see the power of the people. It won't have been realized yet. It won't have resulted yet in racial desegregation or in the laws passed by Congress to allow black people to vote. And if you look at the movement against the war in Vietnam, if you look at the early years and when it was still a minority movement and when the war was still going full blast, well, you don't see that power. And, you know, movements suffer defeat after defeat after defeat before they break through, before there's a certain moment in history where they break through. And we are at a moment now in the war in Iraq where a movement is growing against the war, has been growing. And you can see that in the public opinion polls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can see where, you know, 2 years ago, Bush had 70% of the public behind him in the war. Now he has less than half of the public behind him in the war.
Let me just give the latest numbers I picked up overnight. Only 32% in a CNN USA Today poll approve of his handling. That's under a third.
Yeah, exactly.
40% in August, 50% early this year. 59% now consider it a mistake to have sent U.S. forces to Iraq. Nearly 60%, and 63% say they should be partially or completely withdrawn, up 10 percentage points since August.
Mm.
And only, this is an amazing one, only 21% believe U.S. forces would win the war. 34% believe it's now unwinnable. Is Cindy Sheehan, if there was, you know, the next edition of People's Voices, would she be?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we carry this Voices story, which Anthony Arnold and I have put together sort of as a kind of sequel to A People's History. We do bring it up to the current war. We bring it up to war resistors, to GIs who refuse to go to Iraq. And, of course, Cindy Sheehan has become a phenomenon just in the last few months.
That's right.
And so if we were doing a new edition of Voices, we certainly would include the voice of Cindy Sheehan. In fact, tomorrow in Los Angeles, when we have these readings from A People's History, from Voices, the Voices book, we are going to include some things that aren't in the book.
Ah.
One of the things we are including is the voice of Cindy Sheehan.
Okay, let me tell people about that event. This is Wednesday the 5th at 8 p.m. at the Japan America Theater down at 244 South San Pedro in downtown L.A., fairly near the courthouse area. Readings from Voices of a People's History of the United States. You and Anthony will be the narrators, but the actors reading these Voices of People's History include Viggo Mortensen, Danny Glover, Maria Bello, Josh Brolin, Leslie Silva, Marisa Tomei, Alfre Woodard, Sandra Oh, Vanessa Martinez, and more. For information, contact, I'm going to give you a phone number and an email address, and I'll repeat it again at the end of the show. Phone number 323-692-8338, 692-8338, and the email is voicesla, one word, that's pretty easy, voicesla@gmail.com. You can also get information at that web address I gave earlier, which is the howardzinn.org. So that's Wednesday night downtown. You've done this before, yes? The Voices of?
Yeah, we've done it. Yeah, we've done it several times in New York and several other places. And we've done it with different actors. We did it recently in New York with Wallace Shawn and Christina Kirk, who will also be reading tomorrow night in Los Angeles.
Great. So this sort of, you've also written plays, so this sort of bridges your two, doesn't it?
Oh, well, I'm glad you put it that way. Yeah, I think it does. I wrote a play about Emma Goldman, and I wrote a play called Marx in Soho, which is still being performed around the country by Brian Jones, who read The Voice of Frederick Douglass at our reading in New York. Very powerful. And,
right. So you came to this. You came to the playwriting pretty late in life as well, too, yes?
Well, I guess so.
Luckily, you had a day job.
We never like to admit that we're late in life,
yes.
Right? No, I'm still early in my life. But, yeah, I came to it. You know, I was interested in the theater. My wife was involved in theater. My daughter was involved in theater. My son is still involved in theater. And so I came late in my family.
Late in your family, if not late in life. Let me tell people again that you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Howard Zinn. Howard Zinn is best known for A People's History of the United States, and now he and Anthony Arnov have a new book, Voices of a People's History, in which they do some introducing, but basically it consists of the words of Americans that you won't find in the other books. And as I said, the website to learn more about all of this is howardzinn.org. Let's move to the current situation. You wrote in 1967 the book Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal.
Yeah.
So obviously it's 2005. You could write Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. And in addition to what I'm basically saying is, let's speak about that. But before I do, I just want to quote a little bit what happened recently, and I'm sure you followed this. But LA Times reports October 1st, this is a quote from the LA Times, the U.S. generals running the war in Iraq presented a new assessment of the military situation in public comments and sworn testimony that the 149,000 U.S. troops currently in Iraq are increasingly part of the problem. The generals actually said that the presence of U.S. forces was fueling the insurgency, fostering an undesirable dependency on American troops among the Iraqi armed forces, and energizing terrorists across the Middle East. Leading off with that, Howard Zinn, what's both the military case for withdrawal and the political case for it happening?
Certainly, you know, from the general's own point of view, from the military point of view, it's just disaster, a loss. And when they say so, then you know that all of the elements are falling into place for a withdrawal. The only question is when, how soon. The longer we wait to withdraw, the more people will die. You know, all the arguments about how, well, if we withdraw, there'll be, you know, chaos are absurd because there is chaos now. And the chaos, in fact, is to a large extent, and those generals indicated that, caused by our occupation. It's the occupation that's fueling so much of the anger and so much of the violence. So the most healthy thing we can do is to get out of there as quickly as possible. So even from a military point of view, we're losing, we have to get out. From a larger moral point of view, of course, we didn't belong there in the first place. We don't deserve to be there. Even if we were winning, it would be an immoral victory. I mean, we have won before at certain times, but the winning was not something that we could be proud of. We won in the Philippines.
Right.
We defeated the Filipinos, and what was the result? The result was 50 years of occupation and dictatorship and poverty. So the real question is, the moral question is not are we losing or are we winning. The real question is why are we there? And we seem to be there for oil, for military bases, for the psychological kicks that the people in power get from extending the American empire. So both from a practical and military point of view, the fact that we're losing, and from the long-term and moral point of view, which asks, are we doing the right thing? The best thing that we can do is to get out of there as quickly as possible.
Let me just put one little question to you. Having been through, as I said at the very top, I remember you as one of the first speakers I saw, you know, at some of the earliest demonstrations I went to in the Boston-Cambridge area. You followed how long it took to get out of there. Mm. How do you see this one playing out? In other words, what you've made is the case that both politically and militarily, it's really the only choice.
Yeah.
But how do you suspect it's going to play out?
Ex- exactly how it will happen. I don't know.
Yeah.
I can say confidently it will happen. I can't say confidently when it will happen.
Mm-hmm.
I can say confidently how it will happen. I can say in a general sense it will become more and more obvious that it's a disaster. Public opinion, which is already heavily
yes.
against the war, will become even more heavily against the war. The press, following public opinion, always lagging behind,
right.
will finally speak up strongly. Some of the timid politicians of the Democratic Party, you know, who will talk half-heartedly about, let's withdraw in a year or so,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. Maybe they will be induced by their constituents and by the rise of public opinion against the war to come out more strongly against it. And then at a certain point, the administration, I think, will have to find a way out and explain it to the American public.
Yeah.
Give the public a reason. You know, they're good at that. I mean, they have a huge staff of people.
That's right.
Making up reasons for the stupid things they do. This time they will be making up reasons for a good thing that they
something
do.
For which they have less practice. But
yeah.
Okay,
right.
I'll let you go catch your flight so that you
okay.
can be here in person in
right.
LA tomorrow night.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Howard.
Bye.
Okay, you've been listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kpfk.org. And you can learn more about Howard's work, as I said, at howardzinn.org. His two most prominent books are the classic million-selling People's History of the United States and the new Voices of a People's History that he co-edited with Anthony Arnov. And I'll see you again next week. To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, articles, and so on, you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can listen to podcasts there at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. You've been listening to Free Forum. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
So the transcript is finally out. And it is damning. But it's not enough. We need an unredacted version of the whistleblower's complaint. Nothing else is acceptable. The administration is like, trust us. You can trust me. No, we can't. Donald Trump has lied to the American people more than 12,000 times. He has an administration that traffics in alternative facts and half-truths. And the scary thing is, when we get a half-truth, we're lucky because it's better than the no-truths that roll off his tongue on a regular basis. What we know already is enough to impeach Donald Trump, and I'm glad Nancy Pelosi finally stepped up and did the right thing. Donald Trump tried to coerce and extort the Ukrainian president into investigating his political rival, Joe Biden. This is banana republic bullshit. It's disgraceful. It's beneath contempt. It's a disgrace and an embarrassment and a humiliation to the United States of America. Furthermore, we're putting Ukraine at risk. They have a shadow war going on with our arch rival, Russia. And we're threatening to allow this country to be harmed unless they do the political dirty work for Donald Trump? Think about that. Let that sink in for a moment. Eight times during the conversation with the Ukrainian president, Trump steered the conversation back to investigating Biden. This is a blatant abuse of power and clearly an impeachable offense. I defy anybody to tell me otherwise. Is it not obvious? Is it not clear that Donald Trump is uniquely unfit to serve? He's a criminal, a liar, a filthy politician, a threat to national security, and regularly debases and degrades this country. And how about Trump's unethical, lunatic, lackey lawyer, Rudy Giuliani? The very fact that he is involved in this debacle is proof that something is rotten and stinks, that nefarious activities are taking place. Giuliani has become completely unhinged and needs help, serious help. He needs a reservation in a luxury padded room in Bellevue. That's the only place for him is Bellevue at this point. And is anybody surprised that William Barr is also implicated? Trump directed the Ukrainian president or his people to speak to the Quisling attorney general. William Barr is dirty, unprincipled, corrupt, and compromised. He is a direct threat to democracy and the rule of law, and he needs to go, and he cannot get his big butt out of the door of justice fast enough because he does nothing but perpetrate injustice. He's a Quisling poster boy, an embarrassment. And finally, how about those congressional Republicans, these shills, these Quislings? Is there a patriot among them? Do any of them care about this country anymore? Is there a patriot among them? Are they going to become a party again or an insurgency? They need to make up their mind right now. There is no evidence, none at all, that they will lift a finger to stop Trump's corruption. They are aiding and abetting it. They are enablers of this president and his lies and his attacks on this nation. There is no depth too low for them to stoop in defense of Trump. The Republicans have made it abundantly clear that they only believe in democracy if they win, and they also believe that dear leader Donald Trump is above the law. It's shameful, and history will record these cowards as the dregs of democracy. The Democrats, for their part, need to act swiftly and forcefully and impeach this detestable criminal of a so-called president before he further erodes our norms and shreds our Constitution. This is the Wayne Bessem Show. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.
The Progressive Voices audience has grown to nearly a million regular listeners. Unfortunately, so have our operational costs. We feel it's important to protect the very limited commercial nature of the stream. So to keep up with these costs, we need your financial help. If you want to continue enjoying great shows like Randy Rhodes, Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Leslie Marshall, and so many others on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, please go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button right now. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders of The Laura Flanders Show. Watch every week on Free Speech TV, Link TV, YouTube, or if you're in New York, CUNY TV. Prefer to listen? Subscribe to the free podcast at lauraflanders.org. I end every week with a commentary. I call it the F word. Here's this week's. 20 years after Turtles and Teamsters teamed up to battle the WTO in Seattle, labor strikes and climate strikes are coinciding everywhere but in the media. And that's dangerous. If history is any guide, any minute now some two-bit pundit or shameless president will pit workers against environmentalists, and that would distract us all from the real problem, the rich and the greedy, and a value system that only cares about profits. Last Friday, as 4 million young people marched in the world's capitals for action on climate, countless more were on the picket line supporting auto workers who are out on strike. Both sets of strikers have guts and smarts and a righteous sense of urgency, but the latter's had a fraction of the coverage, so let's be clear, they're all on the same side, the side of a future that we can actually inhabit. Almost 50,000 workers went on strike at General Motors September 16th after management and UAW union negotiators failed to agree on a new contract. GM has bounced back from a recession thanks to a taxpayer bailout, government tax breaks and contracts, and a brutal restructuring of the workforce. Now, even though the company's made $35 billion in the last few years' profit, they want concessions and yet more plant closures and layoffs. This strike, the union's first in more than a decade, is about a contract, wages, and health care, and the exploitation of temps. But it's also about communities. When wages are driven into the floor and the tax base shrivels or factories close, everything from the local school to the local fire department and the water system take a hit. The health and wealth of the place and its people are sucked out to make far-off CEOs and shareholders rich, and it's not good for the people or the place. Working people all across this divided nation have seen it, and that's what's drawing them to round-the-clock picket lines in places like Flint and Detroit and Toledo and Buffalo, and Canton, as well as Wentzville, Missouri, Bowling Green, Kentucky, and Arlington, Texas. Sure, there could be ways, and there are union plans, to transfer those closed plants to green production, light rail, electric batteries, buses, you name it. My personal favorite would transfer the plants to worker ownership. But the big point is, those places are dear to those residents, even if they're of no consequence to the big money's media. know a union worker, or better yet, be one, and you've seen the toddlers on the line and the kids carrying signs, the same sort of signs with the same sort of messages you'll see all Climate Week. We want a future we can live in a society that values people and the planet, now and coming up. Call it climate protection or community protection. It's the same struggle, the same fight. And don't let anyone tell you different. For the Laura Flanders Show, I'm Laura. You can find all our programming and find out about our plans for this coming election year at lauraflanders.org and join our community of supporters at patreon.com/the LF Show. That's patreon.com/the LF Show. And thanks.